Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Hot Shot Wake Up. Hopefully, everybody's doing great out there moving into the holiday season as we push into the new year and roll into the 2024 fire season. On today's show, we have a very special guest, Tim Sheehy, who is the founder and CEO of Bridger Aerospace. If you don't know, they are one of the largest and most successful aerial firefighting companies out there on our planet. They actually just recently expanded into Spain and made a couple purchases of some scoopers out there. But the main headquarters is located just outside Bozeman, Montana. Now, before founding this company, Tim was a Navy SEAL and team leader and completed several combat deployments around the world and has also received many decorations, including a Purple Heart. Tim has a new book out there. It's called Mudslingers, A True Story of Aerial Firefighting. It's a great, great book. We briefly talk about that on the show here, as well as a lot of other things, including firefighter compensation, the struggles with contracts, and trying to get bureaucrats on board for proactive and progressive wildland firefighting measures and funding. But all the proceeds for the book go to wildland firefighters. So it's a great book to check out. It's a great book for the holidays to pick up and give to someone in your family. And again, all of those proceeds do go directly to wildland firefighters. It's a very enlightening conversation. Tim brings a lot to the table when it comes to expertise, leadership, and an understanding of how the wildland firefighting world works, especially when it comes to that aviation side. We chat about the differences between just the way wildland firefighters are treated in our nation when it comes to either structure folks or veterans. And then you look at how wildland firefighters are compensated and treated as well. And Tim makes a good point that it's unacceptable. And this is something that needs to change if we want to manage to keep a wildland firefighting force going within our country. I hope everybody enjoys the conversation. It was great to have Tim Sheehy on. And we hope to have him back once the company has some more updates moving into the 2024 fire season.
I have traveled this year over all the United States, through the Alleghenies, the White Mountains, and the Catskills, the Rockies and the Bitterroot Mountains, the Cascades, the Coast Range, and the Sierras.
Well, hey, Tim, thanks for coming on the show. Greatly, greatly appreciate it. For folks who don't know, Tim Sheehy is the founder, CEO of Bridger Aerospace, based out in Montana. Had a very promising and successful military career in the Navy SEALs as well, and just put out a book, Mudslingers, on the history of wildfire aviation, and it branches off into all sorts of other interesting topics as well. Can you kind of give folks an idea of where you're coming from? You were Midwest raised, right, and made your way into the military, served overseas, multiple tours, and then found your way out to Montana to found Bridger Aerospace, which has grown and grown into this large wildfire aviation company that at least everybody who's boots on the ground, if they see one of your planes, they know it's you. And I think the public's becoming more aware of what it is as well. So can you kind of just catch people up to how you got to the position you're in right now to be running one of the premier wildfire aviation companies?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I appreciate that. And it's been an interesting journey. And I think like a lot of us probably say to ourselves when we're in our 30s and 40s, we look back and say, man, he'd asked me where I was going to be when I was 12, 13, 16 years old, it would be anywhere but where I'm at right now. So certainly was never part of the plan. Like you said, I grew up in Minnesota. I went to the Naval Academy out of high school, and I grew up flying. My neighbor growing up was a Navy pilot, Korean War guy, great American, Harry Tebow. And him and his son started teaching me how to fly when I was about 8. And they landed the plane on the frozen lake we grew up on. I went up flying. And knew right then I just loved aviation. I loved everything about it. And it kind of got in my blood right then. And as soon as I could reach the rudder pedals at age 11, I started taking lessons from Steve and Harry, and they taught me how. And got my license before, you know, graduating high school, and just loved everything about aviation. And I always wanted to be in the military. So there was kind of since I was about 4 or 5, my mom says I would just run around the woods with a stick like a gun. And I became, you know, I always knew I was going to serve in the military at some point in some capacity. And eventually those passions intertwined, obviously, to want to become a military pilot. So that's why I went to Annapolis, graduated high school in 2004, went to Annapolis, and, you know, fall of 04, you know, a lot going on. Iraq was raging. The insurgency in Iraq was in full swing at that point. Afghanistan, of course, was still going on. And the global war on terror, as we called it at the time, was, of course, worldwide at that point. So I, once I got to the academy, I never forget the first, in our first fall semester there, the commandant brought us all into the auditorium. And we just recently had some of our first academy grads have been killed in action since Vietnam. So it was a big, impact on the community. And, in that all hands call, he discussed the fact that, hey, more of you guys are going into the ground forces now. Everyone came here wanting to be Maverick. You all grew up watching that movie. We get it. But guess what? We're in two ground wars. And at that time in 04 and 05, they were taking guys off ships who were Navy sailors and putting them in desert camo and handing them an M16 and saying, hey, go to the desert and stand watch. So there was kind of a different vibe happening where, you know, it was really settling in that these weren't going to be 6 month wars. They weren't going to be 100-hour wars like Desert Storm. 04, 05, it really started to set into the military psyche that these were going to be long-term generational conflicts. And for me, I would never forget sitting in that auditorium and realizing that flying jets and being a military pilot was what I wanted to do personally, but what the nation needed was guys on the ground. So that's when I decided to enter the ground forces instead. I actually tried to resign from the academy, handed in my letter to resign. It talks about this in the book, actually, Mudslingers. And luckily, a senior officer, you know, saw my letter and talked me out of it and said, hey, if you're really going to resign, I wanted to resign from the academy so I could go enlist in the military and fight as a Marine. Yeah. And he said, listen, if you really want to be a service of the country, finish your leadership education and become an officer, because right now we need most in these wars is young leaders who can make decisions on the ground, good decisions on the ground. I don't need any more door kickers. I need young leaders. So stay and finish your commission, finish your education. And that man happened to be a Green Beret colonel in the Army. Kevin McDonald, still a close friend and mentor to mine. And so I went into the Navy SEALs. I went into an Army Special Operations Exchange Program, became an Army Ranger, Airborne Ranger, served with the Special Forces on the Army side, and then became a SEAL. Absolutely loved it. You know, as a guy in your 20s, it's hard to have a better job than being a Navy SEAL all over the world, from hunting drug dealers in South America to several combat deployments throughout the Middle East. And when you look back on those years, I'm only 38 now, but, you know, it was just a crazy time. You know, my wife was an active duty Marine. We met at the academy. So both her and I were deploying on and off constantly. We saw each other about 45 days spread across 7 years, 2 days here, 3 days there. We'd each be deploying on and off. So it was a tremendous time in life. It was a terrible time. It was a wonderful time. It was a fun time. It was a stressful time. It's just that cocktail of emotions that you, I think, really can only experience in war. I lost a lot of friends. I got wounded a couple of times. And you grow up fast.
For sure.
You know, you grow up really fast. And anyways, my last time I got injured, they said I couldn't be an active SEAL anymore. So my wife and I used to come to the mountains of Montana to train before we'd go to the mountains of Afghanistan. And I just loved the region here. And I'd visited as a kid, you know, we had some family across the region. So I'd been out here as a kid, but we'd come out here and do mountain climbing and high angle shooting. And we decided this is where we were going to make our life and raise our family. So we landed here in November of 2014. We bought our land a few months prior, a little hay farm here outside of Bozeman, which Bozeman was still a small town at that point, and it's grown a lot here in the last decade. And we started our company. And the vision for the company was taking some of the advanced surveillance technology I'd used as a SEAL team leader during the war and trying to apply that to public safety. At that point, it wasn't just wildfire. It was public safety, wildfire, search and rescue, border control, kind of seeing how effective aircraft with sensors were in supporting my team on the ground, and then applying that to public safety tasks. And wildfire really wasn't in the top list of things I thought it would be used for. But eventually the local Forest Service guy here saw us flight testing. John Agner's his name. And he came over and said, hey, you know, your twin commander, we had old Piston Commander, which, as you well know, is the preferred air attack platform at the time. Mm-hmm. So we love commanders. You got that infrared camera. Now, you ever thought of flying firefighter, you know, air attack? And I said, I don't know what that is, but, you know, I'm just about out of business now because I'm out of money. So, you know, if you're paying the bills, I'm flying, you point the way. And it just so happened Region 1 had a call Juanita contract up that year, and we jumped through a lot of hoops, got on it, and that was the fire season of 2015. We had one Piston Commander. Through the season, we added a second and a third Piston Commander, and I just fell in love with the mission. I just fell in love with it. You know, I felt like I was back overseas, the camaraderie, the mission, the fact that we were helping people. And obviously, I loved aviation. I loved being of service to others, so it was – I immediately fell in love with the industry. And as you know, to fast forward to the rest of the few years, we've created about 400 jobs. We created some spin out companies. One, the infrared technology we created, we ended up spinning that out of Bridger into a separate company and selling that. We had an aviation fuel company, some fuel tanks here in Bozeman spun out. We sold that as well. And you know, we've kept the core firefighting business, Bridger Aerospace, in place. And as you said, now we're one of the largest in the world. We just acquired more aircraft over in Spain. And we're still growing fast, and I'm incredibly blessed by the team I have around me, and we love the mission. And again, in the book Mudslingers, you mentioned 100% of those proceeds go to the wildland firefighting community, so I don't make any money off it. But I just love the story of the industry and wanted to tell it because I felt like it hadn't really been told yet.
Yeah, fantastic book as well. People should definitely go check it out. Mudslingers again. When you first came to the valley of Bozeman, that Belgrade area. And you proposed this idea to the folks around there. Were they super welcoming? Because I went to the open house you had earlier this year, and the turnout was crazy. Like, there was lines out the gate for people to come look at your planes, look at what you have going on there. Was it? It sounds like, yeah, there are some hiccups in starting this, as there is with all companies. But at what point, you know, was the support there from the beginning? And at what point did you feel, you know, hey, we got something here, and I think we can make a difference with what we're doing?
That's a great question. I mean, the community has been fantastic to us. You know, the Bozeman and the broader Montana business community has been incredibly welcoming. You know, a lot of people don't realize, especially when we started in 2014, you know, Montana was not a great state to do business in. I mean, just the way our labor laws and our tax structure, you know, if you were just had to no geographic ties and you just wanted to plop your finger down on the map of the U.S. and start a business, you know, you'd be wanting to look at states like Texas, Wyoming, Utah. Yeah. Montana was definitely not on that list, just the way, again, our business regulation, labor laws, and tax structure were built. But, you know, we knew that this is where we wanted to raise our kids, and we chose it, you know, for that reason. And the community since then has been fantastic. And I tell the story often. Our current governor, Greg Gianforte, when I started our business, literally, I was a wounded vet, 28 years old, didn't really know much about anything, just fresh out of the military, starting this business. All my wife and I's savings, basically, we emptied the bank account, you know, to start this company. And, you know, the advice I give any founders when I start a company is it'll take twice as long and cost three times as much as you think it will. So just be ready for that. And this was no exception. But, you know, our governor, Greg Gianforte, this is before he was a politician at all. This is 2014. You know, I was starting the company, and he'd heard through the grapevine somehow that this wounded vet was starting a company. And he got my phone number and called me and said, hey, someone told me you're starting a technology related company here in the Gallatin Valley.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm in my barn, just me and my co-founder, another veteran, and we're hoping to make this work. He said, great, let me come by. I'd love to meet with you. And he comes by, and at this point, I think, you know, he's a billionaire, or at least, he sold his company for $1.6 billion to Oracle, another Bozeman technology company. And he came by and just said, hey, listen, I built a technology company here. I can help you with the do's and don'ts, the ups and downs, the who you should know, who you should stay away from. And, you know, spent about 3 hours with us just talking to us about the business and what we should think about doing and what we should avoid doing. And then, you know, said, hey, here's my cell phone number. As you grow, you know, just give me a call anytime. I want you to be successful. I want to see more great businesses grow in the state. Anything I can do. You know, I didn't have any employees to vote for him, which he wasn't in office anyways. I had no money to give him. It was really just a signal of how he wanted us to succeed. And other people like that, Britt Fontenot from the city of Bozeman, director of economic development. You know, the list goes on, all kinds of folks that were really just excited to see businesses here in Montana that you know, traditionally our economy was very concentrated. Obviously, ag is and was and still is our primary industry in the state, and of course, incredibly important. But then you really have like the service industry, which is either you're building, you know, homes for the resort communities, or you're in the hotel and entertainment industry supporting the tourism, which again is important and good. But I think people are always excited to see businesses that don't depend on those particular industries. And I think for us, you know, aviation, aerospace, technology, careers that we could hire. I mean, over the course of time, we hired dozens of MSU interns and graduates, dozens of veterans, and created hundreds of jobs that were, you know, these are well-paying, career-oriented jobs in industries, again, that didn't depend on construction and entertainment and ag, and started to provide that kind of export industry for Montana, to where, you know, we were manufacturing, you know, at one point we had, you know, 100 employees, and we were a factory building defense equipment for the U.S. military here in the Gallatin Valley. And I think that gives Montanans a lot of pride to see that our people in our state are building things that are wanted around the world. So we had great support from the community. As you saw at the open house, twice a year, we try to open our doors and really share our business with the community. We want them to see what's been built here in our valley, the jobs we're creating, and most importantly, the really important mission our employees do. Because as you well know, far too few Americans understand the sacrifice that so many people make every year to protect them during wildfire season.
Yeah.
From ground firefighters, the hotshot crews, the smoke jumpers, you know, the rig drivers, the pilots, the mechanics.
Yep.
I mean, people give up holidays and birthdays and put their lives on the line every year to protect America. And unfortunately, having been a veteran, especially a Navy SEAL, you know, you definitely get the hero complex. You know, we came home and are lauded as great heroes, and we get all the benefits and the charity dinners, and everyone loves us. And then I compare that to how our wildland firefighters are treated. You know, they're underpaid. They don't get benefits if they're injured. You know, their families aren't taken care of if they're injured or killed in the line of duty. You know, aerial firefighters who are private contractors are basically, you know, kind of forgotten about. And our whole wildland firefighting community doesn't get close to the recognition that they deserve for the absolutely important service they provide to America. And that's part of the reason I wrote Mudslingers too, because I just saw that it was such a fascinating history of how aerial firefighting came to be. Of course, a lot of veterans involved in that too. And as I learned that through the years, I felt like it was just a story that hadn't really been told, and I wanted to tell it.
And that kind of ties into one of the chapters in your book entitled Let It Burn, where you talk about something that a lot of folks in the community know is kind of the way it is, and it's something that's frustrated me for a very long time, where, you know, you have some bureaucrats or some agency heads, and these things transition, and people move in and out, but you still have to sit in front of Congress and talk about what's happening in your agency. And there's these hearings where they're asking, you know, what needs to change in the wildfire world, or what's going on in the wildfire industry? Do you have the resources you need? Do we need to change anything? You know, what kind of policy decisions need to go forward? And you just hear folks saying, no, we're good, and we're just going to keep trucking along the way that we're doing business, and everything's fine, and everything's just fine. And even that aspect for a long time, where it's that just suppression, let's put it out. Are you seeing in the industry and at the level you're at and having conversations, is that changing? Do you have hope that these things are starting to evolve to the point where we're going to see meaningful change in the wildfire industry?
Well, I am inherently a hopeful person, but, you know, hope's not a strategy. Hope don't float. Hope don't float. You know, you hope is great, but it's got to be underpinned by tactical progress and decision making that's going to advance the ball towards that hopeful endpoint. And I think I do see progress. And selfishly, I'll point to the United Aero Firefighters Association. UEFA was formed last year, and a lot of what it came from was just the organic bubbling up of the aerial firefighting community. Obviously, there's much more going on in wildland firefighting than just the aircraft. But for us particularly, it was the biggest stakeholders in the industry saying, you know, we have a problem here. There is a problem with how our very disparate and complex web of agencies are dealing with aircraft that are meant to fight fires and protect America.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been through really challenging periods on the aerial side before. Obviously, everyone knows about the early 2000s. And again, in the book, we talk about that and all the unfortunate accidents that happened and the backlash that had to happen within industry and the government to address all those. And we're all worried we're starting to go down that path again. And so UEFA was formed with a specific mission to say, listen, we don't want more money, but what we do want is standardization and professionalization. And we want a contracting structure between the companies and the government that make sure we can be as safe and effective as possible. And I think a great way to look at this, and I've told a lot of people this, and when you explain it to them, the light bulb goes off. When you look at how we treat structural firefighting in the United States versus how we treat wildland firefighting in the United States, it's night and day, night and day.
Yeah.
In a structured firefighting scenario, NFPA, National Fire Protection Association, has a whole litany of regulations, tables, response time standards that govern how we structure our fire departments all over the United States. And it's all structured around response time and response capacity. So always having the ability to respond to any type of fire or medical incident in any urban or suburban area within about 5 minutes. And then there's a whole, you know, flow chart of requirements that each department has to be ready to do in order to be insured and certified. They have to be able to, you know, if it's a three-story condo fire, okay, great. We can respond with a ladder truck, a pump truck, and a rescue rig within 5 minutes. And then within 15 minutes, we have to be able to have a second ladder truck and a second rescue rig. And then within 30 minutes and so on and so forth, you know, and there's a whole standard of response time that dictates how the fire stations are laid out geographically, how they're staffed, how they're equipped, so that the primary mission is response time and response capacity. Because in the 1970s, the NFPA started to roll these standards out, and it led to almost an 80% drop in firefighter casualties and about a 70% drop in civilian casualties related to structure fires in the United States. Because as you well know better than most, if you can get to the fire early and quickly, it's a hell of a lot easier and a hell of a lot safer to put out. And in a wildland fire, a hell of a lot cheaper.
Yeah, it's just a huge advantage overall.
Yes. And when you look at an urban fire department, if they don't have a fire for a week or 2 weeks, they don't shut down the fire station and sell the fire engine and tell everyone to go home.
Yeah.
And then when a fire starts, they, oh, wait, come back. Or if it's an urban fire department, they don't let a building burn and say, you know what, we're just going to watch it and we'll wait till the next house burns. And, you know, we'll fight it. You know, once it burns a whole block, then we'll go ahead and fight it. And then by then, of course, if that's how we treated urban fires, people would be apoplectic. They'd be, what are you talking about? You're going to let five homes burn before you launch the fire engine?
Yeah.
Or you're going to sell the fire trucks and lay off the firefighters because there hasn't been a structure fire in a week? Does that make any sense?
And
when you look at structure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And you look at structure fires. There's been many years now in recent years, especially with the wildland urban interface expanding rapidly, more structures are lost to wildfire than are lost to quote unquote structure fire. So
yeah,
we are in the structure fire business, whether we like it or not. So we should have the ability to support fire incidents that are considered wildland in nature with the same, you know, aggressiveness and response times that we have structure fires. And the truth is, Tim, it wouldn't even take any more money to do that. We just need to take the suppression funds that sit there in the suppression bucket that we can't use till fires burn. And we need to put it into the preparedness bucket so that we actually have the money and we can properly staff the tanker bases, have aircraft on standby, and have wildland firefighters paid appropriately with a predictable wage that's a livable wage. And we can have a professionalized, stable, safe, and well-supported national wildland firefighting force.
Couldn't agree more. And one of the things I hear from aviation folks, and it comes from the crews as well and engines, you know, out in California, they're struggling just to staff a couple engines when they have 37 of them. It's noticeable and everybody sees it who's in the industry. And part of it is that seasonal aspect, and the seasonal contracts are even a problem as well, where a company can't look out and say, I'm, you know, on board for 5 years, 10 years, whatever it is. And for folks who aren't, you know, in the know out there listening, it's, but, you know, we still lay off a lot of our firefighters at the end of the year. And a lot of these companies, whether it's tanker companies, seat companies, you know, structure, you know, contract engines, things like that, these contracts are short term, and it's hard to plan anything around that. And like you said, you know, the structure world, if you don't have a house fire in 4 months, you don't shut everything down and start laying people off. Like, it's coming, like something's going to happen. So you know, there's a lot of people, you know, fighting to change that. And with the coalition you have with the other aviation companies, has the welcome been receptive in DC and places like that when you present them with the issues that you're seeing in the industry?
It really has. You know, we got a great board. John Gould's our board president, 10 tanker CEO, and obviously he's got tremendous credibility in the industry and within the agencies. Paul Peterson's our executive director, another guy with a great reputation in the industry. Tiffany Taylor is our senior policy director. She came over from USDA and has deep experience managing the budgets and contracts. So I think what we've done, you know, there have been previous attempts to kind of form some of these industry alliances, and where they failed is, I think, what they turned into, pardon my French, was just kind of bitching groups.
Sure.
And they got the reputation of, you guys just getting together to basically come in and complain.
Yeah.
And I think with UEFA, we were very deliberate from the beginning to say, we're not just going to be a house of complainers. What we are going to do is be a very well thought out, unified voice for the industry, because a big challenge that's happened before with this is, you know, and it still happens to a certain extent today, each company hires their own lobbyist. And each company goes in to meet with congressmen and senators and agency officials, and they're all pushing their own agenda. Hey, my plane can do this, theirs can't. My retardant can do this, theirs can't. My helicopter can do this, theirs can't. And it was also self-serving for their exact use case that, you know, people got tired of taking the meetings. The congressmen, their staffers, the senators, the agency said, yeah, you're just going to come in and be a shill for whatever you're selling. I'm not interested in hearing that. And what we were very deliberate on doing is saying UEFA is not going to represent any particular company's interest. What it's going to do is advocate for stabilization in the industry for exactly what you said. So that, you know, if you don't give a company certainty that it's going to have a contract next year, yeah, and they have 10, 20, 30 planes and hundreds of employees, then they can't make the investments needed to ensure that what they're doing is as safe as possible. It's a dangerous job. It's a dangerous business. And, you know, it's very rare to have a commercial provider. You don't have this in the DoD almost at all, where we're the ones out actually putting life and limb at risk. You know, I was in a fatal plane crash in 2019. It was training, but, you know, it's a risky job that we do. And we're putting our own employees' lives on the line, and obviously our money on the line too. And frankly, the agencies owe us the certainty that we're going to be able to invest in full motion simulators and, you know, the best radio and communication, the best navigation, the new flight decks, safe quality programs for our aircraft, enough training for our air crews so that they are as safe as possible when they take the field of battle the next year. So far, our reception has been very positive. I think it's very refreshing for the agency and those on the Hill, the legislators, to hear from the agency with one voice. The industry with one voice about how we can actually save American lives and be a safer industry and do things better. Because as you know, what's really starting to impact communities is, you know, people are losing homeowners insurance. And oftentimes it's not just insurance that then has impacts on mortgages. Because if you can't insure the home, you can't get a mortgage.
100%.
And the American dream is homeownership. So the knock-on economic effects of wildfire and our lack of ability to put it out is really starting to have an impact all over the American West. And now it's not even the West just anymore. I mean, last year, New York City was cloaked in wildfire smoke. We were flying fires in Halifax, Nova Scotia. That's east of Maine. Bridger Airspace is flying out there in June of last year. So it's becoming a far more widespread issue. And these lawmakers understand, and they're very refreshed to hear a unified industry voice that's saying, listen, we're not here to argue to pay us more. In fact, we don't need more money. But what we do need is a more constructive relationship with our agencies so we can be safer, better, and provide a more effective product to the ground firefighters who need us for their support.
Yeah, 100%. It provides safety. It provides longevity for the people who have invested in trying to make a difference in the wildfire industry. And it supports that base layer that if that does start to crumble, you start having safety issues and you know, all sorts of other problems that then, you know, cascade and domino like you talked about. And it is a problem, and I'm glad it sounds like you have the ear of the folks out in DC and they're listening to this stuff, because it is important. And just quickly, let's pivot and talk about safety. In the book, you talk about the fatal aviation crash that you were a part of. And you also talk about the history of aviation and wildfire going all the way back to the 1920s and these more rudimentary aircraft up in Canada and Ontario working and trying to evolve that technology. And even a decade or so ago, there was, you know, incidents with tankers that were a part of the federal you know, contracts, and that was well known, and that brought up a bunch of safety red flags. But it, with your career and your experience and the history you had in the military, you know, safety is obviously a forefront, and these other companies I talked to, it's a forefront for them as well. Can you kind of talk about how that's evolved from the beginning of the history of wildfire aviation and, you know, why it is a forefront? Obviously it seems like it should be, you know, pretty obvious, but it's a dangerous job. You yourself have been involved in fatal crashes. And can you just kind of talk on the safety aspect and how that's evolved since the beginning of these early tankers in the 20s?
Well, it's evolved in a lot of ways in parallel with broader aviation safety. You know, obviously aerial firefighting is a uniquely stressful, dangerous mission within an already relatively dangerous ecosystem. But, you know, when you look at aviation safety as a whole, I mean, late 80s and into the 90s, we really saw a revolution in aviation safety that came about because of a handful of very high profile crashes in the 80s, 747s, DC-10s. And it's funny, not funny, it's interesting when you note the driver of that enhanced safety. It really wasn't technology. It wasn't better airplanes, wasn't better engines, wasn't better engineering. It was really people. It was increasing our training to understand that things like crew resource management, aeronautical decision-making, using risk matrices, and understanding how to work better together as a team, not just within the cockpit, but then also taking that horizontal communication, also making it vertical through an organization so that between a maintenance department and a flight department and then an accounting and executive department within any organization, there was alignment of interest around things like quality and things like budgeting and training and performance, so that taking the organizational safety model that has become now, I wouldn't say perfected by any means, but definitely quite advanced, mm-hmm. and started to apply that in the 90s. And why aviation got so much safer in that time period was really the organizational safety concept. Again, that was quality, crew resource management, aeronautical decision-making, risk assessment. And when you looked at aviation prior to that, especially the early days of firefighting, obviously that didn't exist yet. You know, it was literally fly by the seat of your pants. And it was, you know, macho, let's just go out there and get it done. You know, I'll come back alive, I'm pretty sure, and let's just make it happen.
Yeah.
And as a result of a lot of that, a lot of accidents happened. And I talk about the New Tribes mission, you know, the missionaries that were airborne missionaries and how they have a really interesting history tied in with aero firefighting early on in our history. But, you know, they had a number of accidents that, you know, were great examples of how we failed early on as aero firefighters and extreme aviation operators in using organizational safety. So, you know, we've seen the industry evolve. Safety is incredibly important for me. I think we've invested more in our training and safety than most other companies I even know of. And at times, I'll be totally honest, it was not good for us business-wise because you know, you got to bring on investors, you got to bring on shareholders, and they say, why are you spending all this money on a new simulator or another simulator or a leadership training course for your people? What is taking your pilots out in the woods for a week to teach them how to be leaders with an Army Special Forces guy? How is that helping you make more money? How is it helping you make more money that you've brought in, you know, a pattern recognition, mental behavioral therapist to help teach your people how to recognize patterns? How is that making us more money? But making clear the fact that if we have a safer, more professional workforce, that means we will perform better on target. We'll bring our people home. We're not going to lose aircraft. And more importantly, we're going to do a good job on the field, which means we're going to be more desired by our customers. And I've been super proud to be a part of that. I'm the only member of the staff that's been in a crash. Obviously, it was a terrible crash, but it was kind of the classic Swiss cheese accident chain where, you know, tragic engine failure right at the worst possible time and VMC role, and it is what it is. But huge focus on safety, and that's a big part of UEFA's mission, is ensuring that the agencies that are our customers give us the certainty and the ability to be as safe as possible. And it's a fine line because our mission is dangerous. And you can ground any mission for safety. You can throw the safety flag anytime. And you have to be able to still conduct your mission in an inherently hazardous world and still be safe. And that's the difference, because if you want to be totally safe, if your only mission is to be safe, then you just won't take off. Your planes will sit on the deck all the time and you'll be out of business. So you've got to find that balance between how do we conduct a risky mission safely, bring everybody home, but still conduct our mission.
Yep. It's the same way in the air as it is on the ground. We have that conversation all the time. You know, this isn't 100% safe. We have a mission we need to accomplish, but how do we mitigate all those things to the point to where we can still operate safely within a very dangerous environment? And like you said, it's people who are evolving these technologies and pushing it forward, which is always great to see. And it's just a very important aspect. And I appreciate your thoughts on that. In kind of closing here, you guys are still building. You've expanded into Europe. You're acquiring other companies. What does the future look like for Bridger going forward?
Well, the future is we want to be the best aerial firefighting company in the world, not the biggest. I want to be the best. Yeah. Because I think the close air support model that I benefited from as a ground operator in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places, you know, I saw how powerful and life-saving it was to have air support that was properly resourced, expertly trained, and properly integrated with a ground team. And, you know, there was a hostage rescue operation I was involved in 2010, where up in northeastern Afghanistan. And the only reason we found the hostage was due to the advanced aircraft we had. And unfortunately, in the rescue operation, she was killed. But what that taught me was just truly how life-saving, properly integrated close air support can be. And I also suffered from bad close air support. One of the times I was injured was a friendly Apache mistaked us for the enemy and shot a Hellfire right into the middle of my team and I, and experienced what it's like to have bad close air support when it's sure. not properly integrated.
Yeah.
So I know what good aircraft can do in support of folks on the ground. And as we're seeing more and more of these wildland urban interface fires threaten our communities, we got to get there fast. We got to get there quick. We got to be aggressive, and we got to be effective. And that's what I'm trying to do with Bridger. We've had a great contract this year with the Bureau of Indian Affairs for a PC-12 multi-mission aircraft. They're equipped with the best infrared sensing technology, the best software capability that we've designed in-house to share that data in real time with the ICs on the ground. We've got the biggest privately owned super scooper fleet in the world. We've got a robust software development team that's trying to build the best tools with Ignis Technologies in the industry so that we can make sure you guys on the ground have the ability to have the same information we have in the air in a seamless and easy to use manner. So we're going to be trying to innovate in every way possible. We've always innovated here, whether it's infrared cameras, whether it's more super scoopers with better capability. Again, whether it's aircraft with specialized sensors and software, we want to be on the cutting edge. And now we're taking ourselves global. We operated in Canada for the first time last year. And obviously now we just opened our base in Spain with four more super scoopers to cover the Mediterranean region. It's an exciting time. And we got a great team of people on board, and we're looking forward to the next few years.
Well, it's an impressive story. And I know everyone's interested. Whenever I talk about scoopers, everybody, you know, wants to see and what's happening. And that's what people love. They love seeing those planes up in the sky helping out and going across their lakes. So for the folks out there, if you're looking for that story and want to know more about this, check out Mudslingers, a true story of aerial firefighting. And all those proceeds do go to wildland firefighters. It's a fascinating book and a great story that's told. And if you're in the area, Bridger, like you said, has open houses twice a year. It's worth checking that out, especially if you're a part of the community. They're employing a lot of your neighbors in your community, and go support these companies that are trying to make a difference in these wildland urban interfaces, and for the folks that just live out there on acreage and on ranches. They're out there trying to help. So, Tim, I appreciate you coming on in the time, and hopefully we'll be talking in the future.
Yeah, Tom, let's do it again. I appreciate you featuring the book and the cause. And obviously, I appreciate your support of Bridger Aerospace. We're trying to do the best we can to support you all on the ground there.
Cheers. Thank you. Uh.